Thank you so much. June 7th, 1776, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia makes a proposal in the Continental Congress, the Lee Resolution came to be known as, which suggested that these 13 colonies ought to be free, ought to be a free country. 4 days later, June 11th, the Congress appoints a committee of five, including some famous names, Adams, Jefferson, Franklin, who are tasked with drafting a declaration that's famous to us as Declaration of Independence on July 4th, 1776. And between those 2 days in June, on June 9th, 1776, or the 22nd of Sivan, Taf Kuf Lamed Vav, as it's known in Hebrew, a letter is written in Prague, a letter which displays a complex worldview, a letter which presents a nuanced perspective on a different revolution, a letter which is written by the man whom we're going to focus on tonight, and a letter which will provide us with an extraordinary amount of insight into the man, the time, and some of the ideas that he put forward. But I want to introduce Yecheskel Landau, most famously the rabbi of Prague and the author of a work of responsa, hundreds of halachic letters known as Noda B'Yehuda. I want to introduce him to you with first a story. A story that's told about his tenure as rabbi of Prague, and we'll get to his bio and his timeline in a couple of minutes. Prague was a very large community. Across Europe, it was a large city, a very significant Jewish community. Big cities have big issues. And over the course of his decades in the rabbinate of Prague, he handled a host of a complex situations, but this one, in certain senses, may take the cake. Two people walk into his study. They're at each other's throats. One is dressed like a successful merchant in the contemporary style, and the other is dressed like a wagon driver. And they're arguing, what's the feud about? The Yehuda man, the Yecheskel Landau, typically known as the Noda B'Yehuda, the B'Yehuda manages to get their attention, get their focus, explain to me what the issue is. So the fellow dressed as a wagon driver speaks first, and he says, Rabbi, I hired this man, pointing to the fellow dressed as a merchant, I hired that man to drive me. He's a wagon driver, and I hired him to drive me from Leipzig to Prague. I had business to handle in Prague. And it was several days' journey, and one night, at knife point, he forced me to change clothes. He robbed me, forced me to change clothes with him, and forced me to change roles with him, and forced me to be his wagon driver. He cleared me out, he emptied me out, and he owes me, he stole the equivalent nowadays of hundreds of thousands of dollars from me. And I want justice. So says the man dressed as a wagon driver. Noda B'Yehuda says, okay, that's quite a story. And turning to the fellow dressed as a merchant, and what do you have to say for yourself? Second fellow says to Noda B'Yehuda, Rabbi, I don't know who this man is. I've been in your city, I've been in Prague for a couple of days, and for the last 2-3 days, this fellow seems like he's deranged, not really aware of his surroundings, and he's been following me all around town, insisting that I'm him and he's me, and you gotta help, Rabbi, you gotta help me. A difficult issue. Now, Yehuda goes back and forth, cross-examines, tries, you know, look at him straight in the eye, tell me again, tries to catch a chink in the story. He can't make heads or tails of it. Each one sticks to his story. And Yehuda's a little stymied. And he stops to think. And he says, after a couple of minutes, gentlemen, I can solve your problem by tomorrow morning. Tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock sharp, I want you here in my office. Okay. So they leave. Calls in his secretary, his gabbai, and he says, you saw those two fellows just left? They'll be back tomorrow at 9. Under no circumstances do you let them into my study. I will call them when I'm ready. Not a moment sooner. Okay. Next morning comes, after Shachar's, I imagine there's a whole host of people waiting to speak to Noda B'Yehuda. And among that crowd are these two fellows. And the crowd begins to thin one by one. They're called in. They meet with a rabbi in a study, and then they leave. And the crowd thins and thins. And these two fellows aren't sure when they're going to be called. But the rabbi knew that it was urgent. And finally, they're down to three people waiting in the study. And the other fellow is called. Three people, waiting in the waiting room. The other fellow is called, and then he leaves. And they're next, and they're ready to go in. And secretary says, "I'm sorry, rabbi is not ready to see you yet." Okay. 10 minutes go by, 15 minutes go by. Go to the secretary again, time's wasting. Says rabbi, said he'll call you when he's ready. 10 o'clock comes, 10:30 comes, 10:45. You can imagine these two fellows are alone in the waiting room. You can imagine the tension, how thick the tension in the room is. Fellow dressed as a merchant, offers a 50 to the secretary. He can get us in. He says, "We don't do business like that here. The rabbi will call you when he's ready." They've been waiting for 3 hours. It's noon. They're in the waiting room. Rabbi Landau is on the other side of the door. Not sure what's going on. And finally, the door begins to open a crack. And they hear the sing-song of Talmud study. They have the Noid Behuda, who seems to be, they can't see, but sounds like he's sitting and learning, enjoying himself. And they can't believe it. He can learn afterwards. We've been waiting for 3 hours. And the door is just sort of ajar, and they hear him studying, and the tension is building. And then suddenly the door swings open. Noid Behuda was a physically tall, broad-shouldered man, and his frame fills the doorway, and he says, "Will the wagon driver please come in?" And instinctively, the fellow dressed as a merchant jumps out of his seat, and the Yehuda says, "I think we just solved our problem." Now, the story definitely speaks to a lot of out-of-the-box thinking. It appeals to me because of both the wit and the strategic thinking that the Neid Yehuda displays, both of which are born of being wisely attuned to those around him. Now, Chaim Soloveitchik, but there's much more to Neid Yehuda than just wit and cleverness, and even more than attunedness to the people around him. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik has written extensively about seeing responsa literature as a tool for studying history. And looking at the output of some of our more prolific responsa writers, responses to halachic questions, you often get a slice of life. Often you'll have a single writer will have produced hundreds of letters over the course of decades of work. No one called the rabbi on the phone, so if you weren't local, it was all original equivalent of the email, right? So we have hundreds and hundreds of letters written by any one rabbi, and they give you a sense not only of the study of halacha, but often you get a window into what life was like. What I'd like to do tonight is a brief look. I know last week many people told me they enjoyed going sort of getting a sense of the timeline. So we'll begin with getting a sense of the timeline of the Noid Behuda, and then I want to move to a focus on a letter that he wrote about a burning issue, and a letter I think will give us a lot of insight into who he was and what some of the concerns were that he was dealing with. If I can trouble you, pass this down. Last week we had the chance to look at the brief life of Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato in the first half of the 1700s. He was born in 1707, passes away in 1747. So you see, Noid Behuda is born only a couple years later, but his life, he lives for close to 80 years. He passes away a few months shy of his 80th birthday, and his life more or less spans the 1700s. He's born in 1713 in Poland. In a town, the names that I used of locations here follow the Yiddish pronunciation rather than the local Ukrainian, Polish, or Czechoslovakian pronunciation. Those will be on tour. You probably will come across cities known as Apt. You may recognize Apta more than Opatov. He's born in Apt, and at age 18, he marries. He moves to Brat. Yechezkel Landa moves to Brat and to join his wife's family. He also joins the Klois in Brat. Now, Kloisen were interesting institutions. They were very significant for several centuries in late medieval and early modern Europe. A Klois was really a closed base medrash for mature students, often adults. Now, Rabbi Yehuda joins this Klois and is a member of the Klois in Brat for around 13 years. So he's a member of sort of like a, I guess you could call it a graduate institute or almost a postdoc. He's a member of this institute. They're learning both Talmud and Kabbalah. And that's significant. We'll hold on to that point of fact for later on. 2 years later, he becomes a dayan in Brat, a position that he holds until 1745. For 11 years, he's one of the senior halachic judges in Brat. He's a young man, he's only 20 years old, and that appointment speaks to his speaks to the caliber of Talmud Chacham that he is. He takes a leap forward from a career standpoint in 1745. He's at the age of 32, appointed rabbi of a significant town in Poland, the city of Yampol, and it's at that time that he really starts to become more of a communal figure. During his years in Brat, in his 20s, he was studying, he was learning, he was doing some teaching, he certainly served as a dayan, he was adjudicating cases, really become steps into leadership position in 45, in Yampol. And while his leadership begins as a sort of municipal leadership, he's the rabbi of the community, begins to write tshuvos, begins to write responses to handling the difficult cases from surrounding towns, and just to appreciate what the tshuva literature is like, it was, in a sense, almost like an appellate situation. Questions would come first to the local rabbi of the community, and if he felt that this was beyond his scope, so he would take the situation, put it in writing, and send it off to someone he saw as senior. Perhaps not senior in age, but Yehuda was a young man. But he was already handling cases from the surrounding area. And then his leadership goes from municipal to regional to really cross continent. Because in the 1750s, we mentioned last week, when we spoke about the life of the Ramchal, you remember that he was ejected from Italy and caught in Germany for a winter on his way to the more tolerant community of Amsterdam. You remember at the time he spoke about a senior rabbinic figure whom he spent time with commiserating over the course of that winter in Frankfurt, a man by the name of Yonason Eibeschütz. Yonason Eibeschütz was, at the time in the mid-1700s, already a senior Talmud Chacham, and one of the great genii, one of the great Jewish genii of the 1700s, who was denounced as being a closet Sabbatean. Cast our mind back to what we spoke about last week. Remember that in the mid-1600s, Jewish Europe, to extend Christian Europe also, is beset by the messianism of Shabtai Tzvi. Many are taken by him in the 1660s, and then he abuses Kabbalah to gain a following. He abuses the sort of the signs and the systems of Jewish mysticism and builds a following and is ultimately exposed to be a phony. And remember that we had discussed last week over the course of late 1600s, a series of copycats, Jacob Frank and others, and they establish, in a sense, movements. Sabbateanism, Frankism, not necessarily formal movements, but they have groups of followers and groups of people who remain like-minded and remain sort of cast in that mold. Yonason Eibeschütz is accused by Yaakov Emden of being a crypto-Sabbatean, of being a closet Sabbatean, of abusing Kabbalah, of abusing Jewish mysticism in a similar way, and it becomes very ugly. And Yaakov Emden flings an incredible amount of mud at Yonason Eibeschütz, and Rabbi Yechezkel Landau, our Noda Yehuda, as rabbi of Yampol, succeeds to the extent one can in mediating that controversy. And he manages to have a conversation with both parties, and he gets them to come to a works on them accepting a compromise position, wherein Yaakov Enden will cease his attacks on Yonos and Eibeshitz. Yonos and Eibeshitz will stop certain practices that he had that had been making some feel uncomfortable, and publishes essentially the records of this negotiation in a work called Igeret HaShalom. That's in 1752. At this point, he's almost 40 years old. And he really takes center stage. As I said before, his position is no longer merely municipal, it's no longer merely regional, but he's really stepping onto the national stage, national sense of the national Jewish stage at that point. And so it's not surprising that 2 years later he's appointed Rabbi of Prague, which was really one of the most significant communities at the time. And he holds that position for practically 40 years. Now, as we're following the life and development of Rav Yecheskel Landau, it's important to know, we spoke about he studies, at age 18, he's already ready, he's advanced enough to join the Klois in Brat, where there was a blend of Talmudic studies and Kabbalistic studies. He also is, meanwhile, reading on the side as well, and reading science and reading some literature. And he expands his scope of study. Much as we saw last week with the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzatel, a man of Torah Mada in many ways. And then as he matures, perhaps his most significant literary contribution is in 1776, he begins to publish a multi-volume work, his several hundred responses to Noda B'Yehuda, which run the gamut of halacha. They run the gamut of Jewish law, and they also give us a sense of an extraordinary thinker. Many historians feel that with the publication of Noda B'Yehuda, Rav Yecheskel Landau really revolutionized the whole art of writing tshuvas and inaugurates sort of the modern era of responsa writing, of tshuva writing, and you see so much of the person in his writings. Give you an example. There's a very difficult responsa, that a difficult situation he deals with in his tshuvas on Evan Ezra, his tshuvas on family law. It's beyond the scope of our talk right now to get into the halachic detail, but he's dealing with, suffice it to say that he's dealing with an unusually complex situation of adultery. And he's trying to figure out how all the pieces are going to land with the family. And there's such a remarkable blend of halachic brilliance, the way which he marshals sources to deal with the issue, an extraordinary degree of sensitivity to all the different parties involved. He actually develops the concept. I've heard of Herschel Schechter quote this particular response of Noda B'Yehuda several times. It's really been a sort of a seminal source for seeing privacy. Noda B'Yehuda works on developing privacy as a halachic value. And he tries to figure out to what extent can the family's need for privacy play a role in how the situation will be handled. And then that's sort of the first half of the responsa, dealing with the halachic issues. And then he turns to the latter half of the responsa, he addresses himself to the adulterer, who had reached out to Noda B'Yehuda many, many years after the incident, after he had this affair. He had as a young man, now he's a middle-aged man, and he's reaching out to Rav Landau for guidance. And Rav Landau writes, first, the first section is halachic, and then the second section, he says, you also asked me how, between yourself and God, how are you going to do tshuva? How can you possibly repent for this sort of behavior? And his response there speaks to a blend of sensitivity to people and Kabbalistic depth, in the way in which he sort of gives a fellow a prescription for how he can heal himself, how he can heal himself morally, and how he can heal himself spiritually. And that tshuva really brings us to one of the remarkable characteristics of Rav Landau is that multidimensional sense of balance. I mentioned before that he's a man who was deeply entrenched in the study of Torah. Within the study of Torah, there's a Talmudic brilliance and Kabbalistic sophistication. He's a man who's also aware of the sciences and the arts. And then think about the time we spoke before about a revolution. And Behru is writing the letter we're about to take a look at. At the same time in 1776, which is when he publishes the Noed Behuda, across the Atlantic, the 13 colonies are preparing for a revolution of their own. France is not too far behind. And Noed Behuda has on his hands his own sorts of Jewish revolutions. There were many movements, many pieces in play in the latter half of the 1700s. The Enlightenment is making its way into Jewish thinking. And how that should be handled in the wisest way is a question that the Noed Behuda and others are pondering. At the same time, Hasidus is on the rise. The Baal Shem Tov is roughly a contemporary of the Noed Behuda. As a matter of fact, Noed Behuda's own daughter became one of the early students of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidus. Another contemporary of the two of them is the Gaon of Vilna, Rav Yoav of Vilna, who is typically thought of as a man, the standard bearer of the Hisnagdus, the anti-Hasidic movement. What's remarkable is the way in which Becheskel Landau has a lot of similarities, in certain ways, to the Vilna Gaon. They live around the same time. Vilna Gaon lives from 1720 to 1797. They're both rationalists who at the same time embrace Kabbalah. And they're both deeply suspicious, as we'll see in the letter we'll take a look at in a moment. They're both deeply suspicious of the dangers of Hasidus. Noed Behuda, though, is an extraordinarily subtle man. And we'll see that it's clear in the way in which he handles, it was discussed before, the Emden Eibishitz controversy, the way in which he handled Kabbalah in general, and the nuance in the way he responds to mysticism. See, many would start in the way in which we're going to move to now. Many begin, if I could ask you to pass these around for those who are interested. Thank you very much. Many begin the study of Noed Behuda and the Hasidic Revolution with the letter that we're getting to at the 50-yard line. And many would begin with this letter, but I wanted to contextualize it before we see it, because this letter is a very, very, very strong, scathing, anti-Hasidic letter. And we'll take a look in a moment, but I wanted to contextualize it so we... So it becomes clear that it's actually a very nuanced work. Now, the letter is here both in Hebrew and parts of it in English. I'm grateful to Safaria, who provided a translation of two out of the four paragraphs. But more important, perhaps even than the text, is the outline. He writes this letter, as you see on top, and June 9th, 1776. Right? In the midst of those days that the Continental Congress is mulling how to handle whether or not to declare themselves independent. At the same time in Prague, he's penning this letter. And if you'd like, you can follow along within in Hebrew. If you'd like, you can follow along within in English. Or if text is not your thing, feel free to listen. But let me outline, and we're not going to read it all within. But I set off the paragraphs with the headers because the outline is really critical. Let's read the first couple lines. Let's get the sense of the flavor, and then we'll see where he goes with this question. Many sidurim and many haggadahs. If you think back, I think it's probably most common in Pesach haggadahs. I have memories of my father telling me when I was a kid that he says these paragraphs because he remembers his grandfather reciting the L'shem Yichud paragraphs before the various mitzvahs that make up the Seder, before drink making Kiddush, before beginning the story of the Haggadah, before eating the matzah and the mara, l'shem yichud. What is l'shem yichud? So l'shem yichud is a sentence or two that's meant to focus a Jew in advance of doing a mitzvah. Instead of just running to do the mitzvah, you want to get a sense of focus. What am I doing? Why am I doing this? What's the to get a sense of the gravitas of what I'm about to perform, some an activity that God commanded me to do. It's a powerful moment. So you verbalize it. You articulate that in advance of jumping into the action, jumping into the behavior. The rabbi of Goitines reaches out to the Nodeb Yehuda, Rav Cheskel Landau, and he asks, you know, I've been looking at these L'Shem Yichud paragraphs that have become common of late, that have been published widely in Sidur in the last couple of decades. They hark back to the Shla, Yeshaya Horowitz, who was a Kabbalist that had lived been active several decades beforehand. And so this Rav Ber of Goitain reached out to Noi Yehuda with a series of four questions. The first three appear very briefly in the italicized paragraph at the top, and you get a sense of Noi Yehuda's scope. He's handling a difficult question about burial in Yom Tov and burial of children, Rachman Otzlan and Yom Tov. And then he deals with purely Talmudic questions, a question about a Tosus, a question about a Rambam, and then question number four, Al HaRevi'is. If you want to follow along inside, you're invited to. We're looking at paragraph one. In the Hebrew or the English, either one is fine. Hebrew is on side one and English is on side two. He says, in addition to those first three purely halachic questions, Al HaRevi'is, your fourth question, Esher Sha'al B'Nusach L'Shem Yichud. You would ask me about the details of saying L'Shem Yichud paragraph, which is of late become in vogue. It's been published in many Sidurim. You know what I say? You're asking me like this, like that, a couple of words. It's a Kabbalistic formula. You're talking about uniting the four different letters of God's name, Yud and the He, with the Vav and the He, and different aspects, to talk about different aspects of our perspective on God. Achata, you said, you asked me about, should we tweak the language? Would it be more accurate to Kabbalistically tweak the language a bit? Achata sho'aleni nusach amiraso, yosero ilu sholim nomar kitov amiraso. Before we get to the details, the question is, should we be saying this at all? And when in the common perception, when you think about the Noda Yehuda's take on the Hasidic movement, attention is typically drawn to this first paragraph, in which he goes on to say, yes, as I said before, powerful, almost scathing words. He says, I think this is a horrific trend. Ra'acholah b'dareinu. What a terrible disease that our generation suffers from. He goes on to say, until a couple of decades ago, Jewish focus, intellectual Jewish focus, was on the Talmudic tradition, the Bavli, the Yerushalmi, and the literature that surrounds that. Jewish intellectual focus was on that. Jewish practice, traditional Jewish practice, centered around the Talmudic tradition. But he says, "V'doreinu hazeh ki azavu es Toras Hashem mekor mayim chayim." It's become in vogue to ignore the Talmud. And he says, they've found it is poetic, tragically poetic. Lachtsov lehem boros nishbarim. They've sought out their own broken wells, looking for new sources of water, for new sources of inspiration. Unhooked, he sees from tradition. And then he does not hesitate to satirize that a part of what's driving it is arrogance and an opportunity for personal promotion, something we saw when we discussed Shabtat Tzvi last week. Misnasi'im berum levavam, each one wants to say Anochi Haro'eh, each wants to say that I'm the one who has unique access to the gate, heavenly gates. And he says, we would be better off without that. He goes on to say, I have plenty to say, but I won't say it. At the end of paragraph one, Harbe hayalili daber mizeh. I have plenty to say about this phenomenon, V'kishem shemitzel amar davar hanishma, kach mitzel shalol amar davar she'enu nishma. It quotes a Talmudic maxim that it's worth saying something if it'll make an impact. If no one's listening, better to say nothing. Scathing. Very powerful. He's very concerned about where it's going. He's very concerned by what he sees as a move away from substance. A move away from substance towards, sounds like a spirituality that's rooted in little, and a spirituality that he believes may be rooted at times in personal promotion more than anything else. But here's the thing about the Nodeb Yehuda, about the man in general, and this letter in particular. If you take one little piece out of context, you miss the sense of balance. This paragraph is scathing. From this paragraph alone, one would conclude that Nodeb Yehuda is a thoroughgoing rationalist who wants to have nothing to do with Kabbalah, just stick with the Talmud, and that's it. Nothing to do with anything creative, innovative, and nothing to do with anything spiritual. What's remarkable is that even within this letter alone, leaving aside the broad reading that Nodeb Yehuda did, leaving aside the cosmopolitan nature of his rabbinic position and of his statesman-like interactions with Leopold and Mary Teresa and the leaders of the Habsburg Empire, within this letter, you see that even within Jewish sources, he's a far more nuanced man. So in paragraph 2, he moves on to Talmudic analysis. And we'll skip over the details. He said, you wanted to prove to me that that articulating all these Kabbalistic intent, that would be a valuable thing, and you had a proof from a Gemara in Zvachim. He goes on to say, let's open up a Gemara in Zvachim. I'll show you that if you read the text carefully, it's not saying what is he trying to say. And then he says, with a sense of the philosophy of the halacha, he says, and I'll turn your attention, if you want to read along with me, or just listen without looking within, the very end of the second paragraph, I apologize, I have no translation available for the second paragraph, he says, the truth is, if we were to look at that the passage in Zvachim that you marshaled, it makes my point, in the larger sense. He says, because what the Gemara there says is one needs to be careful if you're going to start articulating the details of why you're doing what you're doing, sometimes you may end up shooting yourself in the foot. He says, it would seem to me from that Gemara, kavanas ha-tvil of ha-mitzvos, in thinking about the Kabbalistic aspects of how we pray and why we do mitzvos, there's so much nuance. And he also says so much danger in abusing it and distorting it. Again, thinking about Shabtai Tzvi and Jacob Frank, Kasher Reinu calls that b'mofes. We have seen this with our own eyes. This isn't just an abstract concern. Pshita sheish levatel shlo yichaven kol. It's clear to me that I would not recommend for the masses sort of getting focused on Kabbalistic intent. Dai she'osa ha-mitzvah shem mitzvah. Just do the mitzvah because this is what God wants you. To do the mitzvah because of a relationship with God. Don't get involved in the Kabbalistic under the hood. So this paragraph seems to also, it seems to reinforce that sense that he's a pure Talmudist, a pure rationalist. Not everything is going to be sort of philosophically, Kabbalistically, very simple, very flat, until you turn your attention to paragraphs 3 and 4. And in paragraph 3, you have both the Hebrew and English. Feel free to avail yourself of either one. He says, now you had written, Mashakasa ma'aloso, shetov lios ha-kesher amitz b'dibur u'machshava u'masa. He says, Rabbi Ber, you had written that it's important to have a strong, powerful connection between the three aspects of the three contexts for expressing Jewish practice, thought, speech, and action. He says, I agree with you on that. I agree with you 100%. It's a question of implementation. He says, I agree with you 100%. There's critical spiritual value in verbalizing what it is that you're doing and why you're doing it, and not just a sort of do what you got to do without giving any thought to it, to combine, as we spoke about last week in the context of Ramchal, to combine the external behavior with the internal thought and feeling, and to use speech as a mediator and a connector of those two. He says, I agree with you on that 100%, that a Jew needs to live with spiritual depth, of course. But he says, we have traditional ways of doing that. He says, I don't reject the need for profound Jewish living. He says, but let's look in our own backyard. He says, 2,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, we also had profoundly spiritual rabbis. The Anshei Knesset HaGedola, Ezra and Mordechai, those who come back at the beginning of the Second Temple period, who craft the institution of brachos, and specifically the brachos that we say, Asher Kiddushanu Sasa V'Tzivanu, in advance of performing a mitzvah, he says, there you have it. They were, as Ramchal says, remarkable Kabbalists, these Anshei Knesset HaGedola. And they craft these brachos. He says, why don't you stop and pay attention to what you're saying? Instead of sort of looking for the latest fad, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam. We proclaim that God is blessed. And who is he? Elokeinu, our God, Melech HaOlam, the master, of eternal master of the universe. There you have in just a couple of words, transcendence and immanence. God is out there. He transcends the universe. It's sort of this, the big picture, at the same time, immanence. Personal, intimate connection. He's Elokeinu, and yet he's Melech HaOlam. And let's just continue to read a bracha. Asher Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav. The good Lord, this transcendent God who created the universe, this immanent God who cares about you and me, he endowed us with sanctity. He gave us opportunity to connect to him. How? Kiddushanu B'mitzvosav. With his commandments, with his expectations of us. That's not even a paragraph. That's chapters of thought in just a few words. Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech haolam, asher kiddushanu mitzvosav. Wow. That's an entire theology. And then you say, v'tzivanu, and he particularly expects me to bring this pot to the mikveh. He particularly expects me to eat in the sukkah. He particularly expects me to listen to the shofar. Maybe he says, of course I'm a believer in profound spiritual depth. Of course I'm a believer in using speech to connect action with thought and feeling. Of course. Let's do it. Let's reach back into our deep and rich tradition. He says, that's what brachas are all about. But appreciate what you have in your own backyard. And then it goes on to say, and this is already fascinating. We thought this man was reading its first two paragraphs, we could have come to the misapprehension that this man is a mile wide but an inch deep and no spiritual depth and no mystical profundity. He says, you know what I do? When I have, there are many mitzvahs that call for a bracha in advance, but there are plenty of mitzvahs that don't require a bracha in advance. Some of the most common mitzvahs. Belief in God. So, taking care of kibud av and taking care of parents. Chesed. Doing for others. There's so many mitzvahs that we do. Tefillah. Prayer. There's so many fundamental mitzvahs that do not call for a bracha in advance. Why is a wonderful shir? Not for now. The Ramchal, the Nebi Huda writes at the end of paragraph 3, Kol davar she'ein bracha lifaneha, anytime I perform a mitzvah that doesn't call for a bracha in advance, ani noheg lomar b'fi, my personal practice is to verbalize the following. I'll articulate as follows. Hineni osa davar zeh l'kayem mitzvahs bori. I'm about to visit someone who's ill. I'm about to give tzedakah. I'm about to take care of a parent. I'm about to pray, whatever the mitzvah might be. I'm doing this because that's what God expects of me. I'll articulate that spiritual awareness. But that's enough. Right? So he is spiritually ambitious without choosing to be expressly Kabbalistic. Now, you might say maybe he's not mystical at all. Read the next line carefully. Hakavana b'hu rak Pirush Hamilos. The focus is on the simple meaning of the words, for instance, in a prayer context, or perhaps in the bracha that you're saying in advance of the mitzvah. Now, that's if you stop there, it sounds like, okay, there's no Kabbalistic depth. No, he says, V'chol tikkunim l'mala na'asim me'eleim adei ma'aseinu. All of the celestial impact, the mystical impact that we're trying to have, that'll happen on its own. He doesn't deny that it's there. He just says, don't worry about it. It's there. That'll happen. But our focus needs to be on the here and now. Our focus needs to be on back to fundamentals. And then finally, in the last paragraph, comes an even greater surprise, because in the last paragraph, he finally returns to what it was that this Rabbi Ber of Gottein had been asking about, which was, should we slightly tweak the Kabbalistic phraseology of the L'shem Yichud? He says, well, you asked, you should be said like this, like that. I remember hearing people, when I was younger, people always said it like this. What do you mean when I was younger, people always said it like this? We know what that means. We saw his timeline. We've learned about his story. He spent over a decade in the Klois in Brat, which was a place of advanced study of Talmud and of Kabbalah. He was not a man who was in any way blind to philosophy nor blind to mysticism. But he thought it should be handled and deployed carefully and wisely, with prudence and with wisdom. And that really brings us back to where we began. We began with a sense of revolutions, and we began with a story of the Noid Behuda. A simple seeming story, but it's anything but simple. As with many things in Noid Behuda. It speaks to, as we said before, that sense of balance, and that sense of wisdom, and that sense of thinking carefully about how to approach a situation. Unlike the Vilna Gaon and many others, he too was opposed to... was very frightened about different movements that he saw as potentially being neo-Sabbatean. But his approach, unlike Yaakov Emden on the one hand, the Vilna Gaon on the other hand, his approach was always careful, strategic. Let's figure out how we can make maximum impact and optimize our outcomes in the softest way possible. And he was a person who, in many ways, models for us a sense of ambition and of balance. Ambition in terms of learning, in terms of Torah learning. Ambition, as you saw in this letter, a breadth of Torah learning and a depth of Torah practice and a careful sense of balance. Balance as we've seen in handling people. Balance as we've seen in terms of the breadth of his study. And a balanced, graduated approach to personal growth. I hope that we'll find his story inspiring, and I hope in particular that the contents of the letter that we read will not only encourage us to consider people carefully and not jump to snap judgments about people, perhaps also inspire us in our own spiritual quest, perhaps beginning with our own brachas. I want to thank you so much. I want to once again thank the rabbinic leadership, and thank Mrs. Levitt for making this... for inspiring this evening to happen. I want to thank all of you for coming, and I hope you have a productive trip.
Thank you. Any questions?
Did the time influence him, or did he influence him?
How do you mean?
The answer that you use, the example of this letter, was that were there things going on, many things were going on, because he was on, did that impact him in the way he answered the letter, or does his answer impact the future actions around him?
Probably both are. I think both are true. It's clear as we read the letter carefully that he's aware of and responding to social realia, and he's talking about what he knows of the history of the late 1600s and what he's seen with his own eyes in the early 1700s, and he is trying to shape policy. And there are other responses also. This is the most famous. This is the most blatant. There is another response that we didn't have time to read. It appears on the bottom of the second page. He also responds with respect, but with caution, another Kabbalistic, or he sees as Kabbalistically inspired innovation of the Shla, who is the one who had to put forth the L'shem Yichud. So he is aware of, he's very aware of social movements, both Jewish and beyond, and he is trying to shape events. Absolutely.
Is there any indication that in the book, an anthology of Tshuva, that the rabbi, this or any other rabbi, would say, I made a mistake 12 years ago, I really think differently now, and I want to modify that answer?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Intellectual honesty is key. The Mishnah, one of the few selections of Mishnah, which is a self-referential. Mishnah is the first work of Tarash Valpeh. Mishnah doesn't really come with an introduction of its own. Rehud Nasi didn't write, in the modern sense, an introduction to Mishnah, but more than halfway through in Maseches Edios, there are a handful of Mishnahs that talk about self-referentially how Mishnahs were written. And one of the points that Mishnah makes there, I believe, is to stress intellectual honesty and to recognize that that Tanam would sometimes retract a position they had formerly held and be clear about it. Rambam is famous for doing that at times. In the modern era, I think it's probably most famously practiced by Rav Moshe Feinstein, who has a number of responses where he writes, you know, I had written this, but now I think that. I believe that Yehuda does it as well. Now, Yehuda, his tshuvas were published in two sets. There's Madura Kama, section one, and then years later, section two, which was published posthumously by one of his sons. And in Madura Tenyon, I believe there are a number of letters where he refers back to what he wrote in Kama and continues, and there are a number of letters where he refers back to what he wrote in Kama and says, I think about it some more, I want to either entirely change my, recant my position, or I want to tweak it. Yeah, sure. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much.